and use it, successfully in that kind of environment. So it was quite a feat. And yes, the auto iris adaption of the lens, we closed the lens down. The auto iris, which of course today cameras, surveillance cameras, and all are very, very necessary and straightforward device. But at that time, it was quite a feat to build that auto iris lens. So yeah, they did the things that they did. But now that we look back on it, it's just mind-boggling, Dick. Over.
Yeah, boy, do they need modern-day computers. I mean, nowadays we could have put 5 computers on board, and each one of them would have 1,000 times more capability than the computers that they had at that time. But the computers they had at that time would be being developed as state-of-the-art and edge-of-the-art just for the Apollo program. There are many people who think that the Apollo program pushed our computer development capability way out in front. It's very similar to what happened to things like radar and other kinds of radio communication that was pushed way out in front because of World War II. In both cases, you had a near wartime mentality. The mentality of a wartime, and I've seen it on a couple of occasions, makes people think very differently, think and act very differently. You get heroic acts out of people that you just wouldn't believe. You get a can-do attitude that's just out of sight. No project manager under non-real conditions is capable of recreating that situation where people will act that way. You read that Radlab, Radiation Laboratory series of books that was created by MIT after World War II, and boy, did we make a lot of breakthroughs. And when it comes to what we thought was a space race, a really serious space race in the late 60s, that mentality caused us to, as a nation, develop stuff that would have taken many times longer to develop before. And so it's hard to believe that Moore's Law, Moore's Law is the one that says, he calls it Moore's Rule, but it's really Moore's Law, says that the number of transistors you put into an integrated circuit chip is going to double every 18 months. And I think he first declared that law somewhere around 1967, right during the time of the Apollo program. He said that every computer chip you make is going to double the number of transistors every 18 months. I've heard other versions of it every 12 months, but the conservative one is every 18 months. And people said, okay, we'll get a few cycles of that. Year after year after year, since 1967, we still are doubling the number of transistors every 18 months. He's right on target. What he used as raw data to come up with that law, I don't know. How he saw that far into the future, I don't know.
Repeater, time out.
Maybe some number of years from now, to continue to carry it out, we're going to have to make transistors which are a small number of molecules per transistor. I'm not quite sure what's required. But when it comes to computer memory and number of chips and computing power that we put into a small package, wow. I can remember the very early days of my first computer, which I guess was a Sinclair. I think it had 1 KB of memory. 1,000 bits or bytes of memory is what you could store. And in order to bring that up to 20 KB, you had to buy $20 worth of hardware or something like that in those days. Nowadays, a gigabyte is nothing. In those days, 1,000 bits of information was a big deal. How much memory was in the first computer you ever used, Mel? K2KUI, K2RIW?
Actually, nothing, I think. It was a... Gee, what was that computer? I got that thing that was a contraption I put together. I don't remember. Well, I had the Heathkit. I learned somebody had given me, in fact, I still have it. Heathkit came out with this contraption that you learned to learn computer technology. So what it really contained was a lot of switches, basically. And I guess you could call it a computer. But if I remember, one computer that was very interesting was this one that actually loaded on paper. You punched paper, and you put it into this thing, and I'm trying to remember what the name of it was, but the readout came out on a strip of paper which you had to translate, Dick. I don't remember, but what it was that made that, but that'll be back in the late 50s, over.
Was that computer tape seven-layer, seven-level ASCII code, Mel?
Actually, it was a unit that you punched in, and you had to use a code to load it. In other words, you couldn't punch it in a straight talk. But, you know, when we talk about computers, there was a number of different calculator systems, mechanical contrivances that were around. In fact, they used to, the American Cash Register, or one of the major units that they used in the banks to compute interest rates and all. And I had one of those when it was dumping them. I got one of them. It was a big contraption, bigger than a typewriter. And what you did is, if you put in a math problem into it, you'd hear it clicking away, and it's a little, and it actually came up in numbers on top, and I don't remember. It went out quite a number of numbers, Dick, but you'd see them popping up one at a time, mechanical. It was all mechanical. It was like, oh, you looked inside there. It was a nightmare of levers and relays. And no relays, but a lot of levers and gears, over.
We've come a long way, Melvin, and you and I have watched it happen, and the modern-day students have trouble appreciating it. They've always had their iPods and their MP3s and whatever, Walkman in the early days, handy talkies. I can remember, let me think now, late 60s, the idea of being able to carry a ham station over your shoulder, that ICOM, I can't remember the model number, or was it a Kenwood? I can't remember the model number. TR-22? I think it was one of those. What was that again?
Drake, I have one. Still have one. Drake TR-22.
I've got one also. And I added a synthesizer to it. Let's see now. Belkey synthesizer. What was it? GLB something or other synthesizer? Remember that model number?
I never added it. I still got the crystals in there. And somewhere in the closet. All complete. I guess it's a collector's item by now, over.
Mel, was the name of the computer Altair? The computer that you built, Mel, it's WS2N.
Yeah, he said, was it an Altair computer?
Heathkit, I could look it up. I don't know, somewhere around I could find it, but it was Heath, over.
He had the 100 trainer? What was the 100 trainer? T3100, 8-bit microprocessor trainer. This is KB2MAR, maybe that's the one. Yeah, I don't recognize that one. I recognize the Altair as an early computer kit. And Heathkit had a competing computer kit. And eventually the Sinclair ZX80 came along for something like $150. And it used a television set as the display device. And with that memory keyboard, you could program simple things into it. And it was a kind of computer. And along came Hewlett-Packard in roughly 1972 with the HP35. And all of a sudden you could do, let me think now, add, subtract, multiply, divide, square roots, logs, anti-logs, sine, cosine. I don't think it would handle complex. I think it was the later machines, like the HP15, that would handle complex. But that HP35, in its day, that started off as $450 as a handheld calculator, as they called it. And in 1972, that was the cat meow. Do you remember those, Mel?
But though, in fact, just remembering what was one of the early computers. Believe it or not, Bell and Howell put out one. It was cute. It had a little keyboard on it. Not, you know, what we picture now. It looked like more or less like a touchpad keyboard, early version of a touch keyboard pad type of device. I'm trying to picture it now, but I remember Bell and Howell, believe it or not, put that out, Dick, over.
Yeah, Bell and Howell, Bullmark was another one of the handheld computers. A number of them came out in the very late 60s, but early 70s. I think I still own an HP 45, and you'll be amazed how many of the calculations for the design of a very significant military receiver were done on the HP 45 that I own. At the time, it was the best thing that we had to give rapid answers for setting ballpark figures for some of the major design philosophy of this massive system that I was involved in at the time. So we've come a long way. What kind of mail are you getting these days, Mel? And should we try to answer any of those? KQKEY, KQRIW?
Hey, final word on it. I have here a piece of 1940s. Gee, it was built in the 40s. During the World War II, the computer that was in New York City that was had 12,000. I said 12,000. People are going to say, how many? Yes, 12,000 12AU7 or 12AX7s, I think. Yeah, 12AX7s, I believe in it. That was located in RCA owned that, and they built that during World War II. Was for the Navy Department to make charts for zeroing in the guns, the big guns on the battleships. So when they were wrecking that thing, I got one of the so-called plug-in modules, Dick. This thing was humongous, and I don't know what its capabilities were, but it was unbelievable that they were that they wired this thing with 12,000 tubes over.
And QGOT.
Hey, Vivian.
Hey, Eric. Well, we were earlier asking questions about that first camera. That very first camera used on Apollo, did it have a color wheel, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I sent you that article. The very first camera did not. The next generation did.
Okay. How many of the Apollo missions? Apollo 12 maybe had it, maybe 14. But I think 14 or 15 is switched over to that RCA color camera that they mounted on the lunar rover car that was built by RCA Astro. Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. Actually, the second part of that article will be out in next week. And from what I remember, the changeover came on Apollo 12, so the color camera wound up there. It was a mix of the black and white and the color at first.
Because I think you're saying the only way to get color in those days was by color wheel. They didn't have the three-gun system, so to speak, the three-Vidicon-like system. Is that true?
Actually, there was discussion of the stripe filter method, and that stripe filter method is still used in today's rather cheap home video cameras. What that is there's red, green, and blue stripes down the face of the pickup device, and it actually started. Sony made their first stripe tube camera, I think it was 68 or 69. It was a DXT-1000. It actually had two tubes, one for luminance and one tube that had color stripes on the front of it. And by the way, when you put stripes on the front of it, you get three different spectral responses, which you actually filter out with filters. So you separate the red and the greens and the blues by having different bandpass filters. Because the frequency response of each stripe has a different sits in a different place and spectrum-wise when you actually look at it in video when it comes out. But color wheel wasn't the only method. The reason why they were using color wheel is because they did not change the transmission systems that they were using, and they only had 500 kilohertz worth of bandwidth. So that was one way of doing bandwidth reduction. Using the color wheel, it was sequential. Red, green, and blue, and then the pictures would have to get put back together on the ground so that it would turn into color.
I do remember reading the portion of the article you sent to me where the designers were complaining about the fact that bandwidth had to be limited to 500 kc, and boy, that gave them a really heavy restriction. And therefore, I guess scan conversion and local storage and all kinds of things had to happen on the ground before broadcast of the signal could take place. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct. It was 10 frames a second. The way they actually turned it back into real video is they had a long persistent phosphor monitor, which then had a real broadcast camera pointed at it, and that's how they did the scan conversion.
You'd be amazed how many military systems around that time used a scan conversion tube where all of that's built into one great big vacuum envelope. But that's essentially what was going on. Scan conversion in the days before digital storage and readout at different rates was very primitive and low in resolution and had smearing effects and, oh boy, all kinds of artifacts that you don't really want to talk about. Who else wanted to sign in? Give me your call letters again, K2RAW.
2EO, Dick.
Rich recognized. Who else was the other person?
KC2FYJ.
Yeah, KC2FYJ. I think you signed in earlier. Start off your name and your question or comment. Then I'll go over to Rich in that order. Go ahead.
Actually, I hadn't, but I've been listening for a little bit, and I think I have the answer to a couple of questions that you posed concerning computers earlier. I think the punch tape computer that you were looking for was the Harvard Mark I, designed by Howard Aikens in 1944. And I think the tube computer that was being referenced before was probably the very first general purpose computer, and that was ENIAC. And it didn't have 12,000 tubes, it had 17,468 vacuum tubes, 7,200 crystal diodes, 1,500 relays, 70,000 resistors, 10,000 capacitors, and 5 million hand-soldered joints. It weighed 30 short tons, was 8.5 by 3 by 80 feet, and took up 680 square feet of space, and consumed 1,500 kilowatts of power. Input was possible from an IBM card reader, and an IBM card punch was used for output. And I got this off of the Wikipedia article.
Yeah, I think Dick was talking about the targeting computer that the military had made, but the ENIAC was first, and then the UNIVAC 1103.
Fantastic. Harry, what business are you in? It sounds like you're in an allied business. Go ahead, Harry.
Well, I manage Citibank's cash machine network. I've been doing computer work since the late 60s in one way or another. That's what my master's is in.
Fantastic. Okay. Fun stuff. I think computers have come a long way. What do you think, Harry? Can you imagine the amount of power that machine had compared to what you can put in your pocket today? Wow. I mean, I carry around an HP 50. I forget what the model number is. HP 50 something or other. And what it can do with the fast Fourier transform. Yes. HP 50G. You give it a matrix of data, which you can read in optically if you want to. And you say, give me a fast Fourier transform. Or punch another key and give me an inverse fast Fourier transform of that. One key punch, all built in as a subroutine, so to speak, in the ROM of the machine. Something like 3,500 commands you can give it in 6 computing languages. I mean, I can write one line of code in the basic Fortran, Lisp, Forth, reverse Polish, one line of code, and it figures out what I want. Wow. And all that goes in my pocket, and I carry it to work every single day. Now, a man who uses machines like that is Rich, N2EO. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Good evening, N2EO. Dick, on another subject, dealing with amateur radio, of course. You know, my car has, like, 3 zinging antennas on it. It looks like a porcupine. And what's been happening lately is people will stop me in a parking lot and say, what is that? And I say, I'm a ham radio operator. And they say, what? I get a dumb look. So I say, amateur radio. And they have no idea if I say ham radio, amateur radio. Now I tried using the term shortwave radio. People have no idea what we do. I don't know why this phenomena 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, people at least had a vague idea what ham radio was. During the CB boom, they thought of TV, but at least they were somewhere within the ballpark. Today, they have no idea what it is. I had one person that insisted that I was tracking somebody with homing devices. He swore up and down that's what it was. Another person once asked me if I talked to truckers, but never mentioned CB or ham radio. And most people just give me a dumb stare when I say amateur radio, ham radio, shortwave radio. Just a dumb look. What's going on, Dick Antulio?
Give the man a medal. I used to put a bumper sticker on my car that says, yes, I am talking to Mars.
Yeah, I've also been accused of tracking somebody. I had a simple 5/8 wave ground plane whip on the car, pulled into a gas station. Unfortunately, I was pulling in right behind another guy who pulls in the gas station. He gets out of his car and he runs over and he starts accusing me of tracking him. And I could have told him I worked for the FBI. Oh, I could have had a grand old time with it. And yes, I told him what it was, and no, he didn't understand it. A certain percentage of the population lives a very simple life, Rich. They don't dig into technology. They watch the soaps. They watch the sitcoms. They watch their football games, maybe at the local bar. That's where their life is. And so what's going on in technology here? They don't know. You can't blame a person because he hasn't been exposed to something. If he just happens to live in some particular corner of the world, in downtown Queens or Brooklyn, you know, a high-tech area, but he just happens to live in some little corner where nobody in his block ever discussed that subject, he never got exposed to it, he never knows. I mean, there's a bunch of things you and I have never been exposed to. And so, there is no, you know, jack-of-all-trades, Leonardo da Vinci-type human beings. Almost impossible these days. No matter what technology you work in, you've got to dig into that particular one, and staying current in that particular one is tough enough. And try to, I supposedly am an RF maven, supposedly. So I get paid to do that. And yet people are extremely unhappy about how little computer savvy I am. I use handheld computers to do all my work. I do very little on desktop. When it comes to serious computing and setting values and whatever, I do very little of it on desktop machines. And when it comes to the normal protocols of desktop machines and the modern day programs that work with them, I'm a bit of a dinosaur. So I'm one of those. You could mention a whole lot of very popular computer programs, and I'm not very familiar with them. This degree says holes in our education, no matter who you are. The one guy I know who doesn't seem to have any holes in his education is Eric. How the hell have you pulled that off? And I think it's because you've lived two life
repeater. Time out.
Eric, I think it's because you've lived two lifetimes and you worked for four different, five, six, seven different companies. Is there a subject that you feel uncomfortable about, Eric? We haven't heard of it. KE2EJ, K2RIW?
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, I got to admit that ever since I was 14 years old, television just fascinated me. And most people don't realize that broadcasting not only encompasses electronics, it encompasses optics, it encompasses mechanics, it encompasses chemistry, believe it or not, it encompasses physics. I mean, think about a VCR, just a plain old tape recorder, which is becoming the thing of the past. I mean, it's mechanical, it's got servos, it's got electronics, it's got everything you can, it's even got optics in it, cameras, or optical devices. So I've been exposed to a lot of stuff. I go back 15, 20 years, I used to make laser discs. And how do you make laser discs? Was it one-lot argon laser? I used to tune up the device and actually burn holes in the ceiling with the bloody thing all the time. It's funny, when I was 72, I bought a 6800, which was like almost $100 in those days. and built myself four cards with 4K of static memory on it. Built a back plane, put the thing together, and I had myself something that almost looked like a PDP-11. I fell in love with Motorola's programming, you know, assembly language, because it was very close to the PDP-11s and the Vashes that I got used to. So, well, Vashes didn't happen at that point, but, you know, even the machine that Heathkit sold, that was a PDP-1123. Actually, I still had a working Klemenko and a working Altair 880, which I still use. K2RWK, 2J.
YJ.
Mr. FYJ? Fantastic, Eric. Go ahead, Harry.
Well, a couple of additional items. In keeping with what Eric is talking about, I have my first Z80-based computer, which I built. It cost probably, when all said and done, I probably poured about $8,000 or $9,000 into it, which is one of the reasons I don't want to throw it away, even though it's almost useless these days. And the other thing I thought I would mention is I was just poking around on the web and discovered that in 1995, as part of the 50th anniversary of the ENIAC, which was developed at University of Pennsylvania by Eckert and Mauchly, some students in the engineering department designed and fabricated ENIAC on a chip. It's the full ENIAC design, complete with all of its components that took up those 680 square feet of space, fabricated down onto a 0.5 micron triple metal Enwell CMOS chip that's 7.44 millimeters by 5.29 millimeters and contains about 174,569 transistors. Thought you might find that interesting.
Yeah, that, did they include the air conditioning? Because the old air conditioning was bigger than the computer.
Needed for the ENIAC on a chip.
Does anybody know what year Mr. Moore wrote his law? Was it in the late 60s? I think it was.
And I'll look it up.
Okay. And he's been doubling the number of transistors on a chip every single 18 months or 12 months. I'm not sure which it is. There's a subset of his law which says you double the number of lines of code that's in a microprocessor, that's in a computer, that's in a commercial appliance every 18 months. I think you double the number of lines of code. So this stuff is just getting more and more complicated. Where is it all going to lead?
Got it.
Go right ahead, Harry.
Okay, Moore's Law is, again, from Wikipedia. Moore's Law describes a long-term trend in the history of computing hardware. Since the invention of the integrated circuit in 58, the number of transistors that can be placed inexpensively on an integrated circuit has increased exponentially, doubling approximately every 2 years. The trend was first observed by Intel co-founder Gordon E. Moore in a 1965 paper. It has continued for almost half a century, and in 2005 was not expected to stop for another decade at least.
1965. That makes it 44 years. Doubling every 18 months or 2 years. I've heard various versions of it. Every single year, 44 years. Where does it end? And, there are people designing things that you put in your pocket these days. Call it an iPod third generation S or whatever. Well, what are they putting into these days? They've got the WAN, LAN, Bluetooth, cell phone, camera, computer, iPod. What is not going into those things? Man, it does a little bit of everything. And everybody wants it smaller and smaller. They don't care what the size of the battery is. And they don't carry a spare battery in their pocket. They don't worry about the battery going dead. We more practical people worry about, okay, I can do this operation for 2 hours. I can do that operation for 3 hours. I can only do that operation for 1 hour. And where's the, if I'm on an airliner doing that calculation, where's the spare battery? Do I have another one in my pocket? Am I allowed to carry that? And so on. We worry about those things. The public all of a sudden gets themselves into a situation where the battery goes dead. And they act surprised. Particularly if it's their main backup device to save them in a life and death situation because they're in a desolate area somewhere and their cell phone runs out of power. Craziness. People don't worry about those details. even though it's a life and death situation. You'd be amazed how many times your life can be saved if you've got some kind of a communication device in your hand. And without that communication device in your hand, your chances of surviving are drastically decreased. A lot of people take that for granted. When people say, no, not in my backyard, you're not going to put that cell site, you can relatively easily calculate the number of human lives that are going to be saved in your town if you allow that cell site to be installed in your town. And there are towns right now that are very actively working extremely hard to eliminate every antenna in their town. Not in my backyard. Get those things out of here. Craziness. Real misunderstanding of modern day technology. I'm sure you guys have got some comments on this. KQRIW listening.
Before you go there, I've got another comment on Moore's Law.
Let's hear Moore's Law. Go ahead, Harry.
This is a corollary law called the Great Moore's Law Compensator. It's generally referred to as bloat, and it's the principle that successive generations of computer software acquire enough bloat to offset the performance gains predicted by Moore's Law. In a 2008 article in InfoWorld, Randall C. Kennedy, formerly of Intel, introduces this term using successive generations of Microsoft Office between the year 2000 and 2007 as his premise. Despite the gains in computational performance during this time period, according to Moore's Law, Office 2007 performed the same task at half the speed on a prototypical year 2007 computer as compared to Office 2000 on a year 2000 computer. How's that for lousy?
Yeah, what I think we're talking about here is that if you have the organization and protocol in place so that you can write command, or it's called CMM, capability maturity model level 4 or level 5 software, if you really know how to write structured software that is compact, efficient, transportable, bug-free, and whatever, you don't have to do that. But if you're running an organization that wants to cut corners, claim you've got all kinds of extra capability, put all kinds of spaghetti code into your particular software, and then say, well, we're not going to debug it, we'll send out a whole lot of beta site versions of it, and we'll let the customer find the bugs for us. There's an awful lot of computer programs that people pay money for that is very buggy in the first few generations. Wonder if anyone's ever run into that one. KQRIW.
They absolutely have. As a matter of fact, IBM used to be guilty of that. The reason that it was acceptable is because when someone came up with an error, they'd have it fixed in about a day and a half, as opposed to when Microsoft has an error reported, they take 6 months to fix it, and then they charge you for it, whereas IBM would provide it as just an upgrade, automatically applied by their field engineers.
Fantastic. Eric, go ahead with your comment.
Now, if you go into the history of how Bill Gates started his company, he basically, most people don't realize it, but MS-DOS was what would you call it, EDOS? He bought, it was CRDOS, that's right. He bought Digital Research's program and built on it. So he's not in the habit of building on something else. And rather than just starting fresh and building from the beginning, they just kept building on top of what they were building on top of. So it would get worse and worse. I mean, one of the things that Apple got, or that Steve Jobs really got upset at, when you load a PowerPoint project and you just put one line in, okay, that one line will take up 3 megabytes worth of space as opposed to Apple's program, which may take up less than 10 kilobits to print out one line. So there's a big velocity thing going on here. And if you look at the history of Microsoft, they're notorious for doing that stuff. TW Basic, which is the Microsoft Basic, was written by one guy, that one genius guy that he hired originally when they first started the company. And that became the forerunner of all the other stuff. They just kept building on top of it and building on top of it. And even now we have Microsoft.net, which was actually part of Visual Studio and Visual C. Rather than starting from the beginning again, they've just built on top of it and built on top of it. So the old bugs that are there, there's patches for them. You'll notice that when you download a Microsoft operating system, it's version 2, you know, it's the service pack 2, service pack 3, service pack 4 to fix the bugs that show up. But there are other companies that don't take that philosophy.
Are these problems going to continuously increase the popularity of Linux systems? What do you think, Eric?
Let's put it this way. You, the average computer user, well, not you, because you're not the average computer user. You're not, you know, the average person buys Office and expects to type letters on it. He doesn't care about what makes it run. He just cares that if he types it and he hits the button that he can get it to the printer and he can save it pretty fast. And that's it. So it doesn't matter to him whether it takes up a whole disk to keep his letter or not. So there are other companies that, that's why Linux is so popular for people that have a little more computer savvy. And it took a long time for the Linux folks to, you know, build the GUIs to make it more acceptable to people that can't deal with command line stuff. But, and with it being GNU, as they call it, and it is written freely by lots and lots of people who are, in essence, hobbyist programmers, so to speak, they actually come out with some good stuff. So Microsoft is not the only game in town. If you look at Google, Google has their equivalent to Microsoft Office. Some people like it, some people don't. It's a lot faster, though. K2RIW, KE2J.
AC2FYJ.
Go ahead, Harry.
There's also a package called Star Office that runs on Sun Solaris systems, and it's supposed to be 100% Microsoft Office compatible. And the wonderful thing about it is that it's free. And I'm not sure, but I think it may be written in Java, which makes it platform independent. So there's a lot of stuff out there that will compete with Microsoft. The problem is that they are so firmly entrenched that it's going to take a monumental effort to knock them out of their position of market share. There's huge numbers of billions of dollars invested in software that will run in Windows environment. And the only way that you're going to knock them out of the batter's box, so to speak, is if you can come up with an operating system that works at least as good as Windows and that will run Windows programs 100% cleanly. And in order to do that, you probably are going to wind up having to violate some Microsoft patents on some of their software. So it's a very, very difficult situation to try and knock them out of the box. It may happen with the passage of time because they continue to be, I guess the best phrase to use is egomaniacal, and they do not have the best interests of the industry at heart. They have the best industry of their pocket at heart, and that may ultimately be their downfall, maybe, but it won't be anytime soon.
Thank you, Wild. Whoever that was a perfect double with somebody. We didn't get a single word. Bernie, go ahead.
Back to the comment about the size of software that's coming out, or what's referred to as bloatware. One of the things that's changed is time to market. People want software now. They want it out quicker. And so hard disk drives have quadrupled or even bigger in size, terabyte-sized hard disk where you can come by now. If you're not running 4 gigs of memory on your desktop Windows, there's no sense not to. 4 gigs of memory is less than $100. And so what we sacrifice is size of program for getting to market quicker. Well, the hard disks are bigger, the RAM is bigger, so it doesn't really cost anything. So really what we're looking at is trying to suffice the market demand of there's a need, we want a program to solve that now. So that's kind of one of the perspectives of why we don't bother to write as tight a code as possible. If I need to include a module, I'll grab the whole module and throw it in and use it, even though there's probably 50, 60, 70 lines of code in that class that can be bounced. It doesn't matter. I don't have time to do that, and the customers are willing to pay for that time. Just my thought, KGY.
Yeah, I see where you're going there, Bernie. I think I agree. There's many ways of looking at this whole thing. Harry, we don't have to knock Microsoft out of the batter's box. The fact that there are competing pieces of freeware is giving them just enough competition to at least partially move them in the direction of being a little bit more egomaniacal, as opposed to be egomaniacal, as you say. So thank goodness there's a little bit of competition. We don't have to knock them out of the box. We just have to rattle the sabers periodically, saying, you guys better not get too bad, because we do have alternate systems to fall back on. That's a philosophy that might work. What do you think, Harry?
Whoa. I think it's a dangerous philosophy to rely upon, because Microsoft has such deep pockets that they can buy out the competition and then squash those competing products, which they have done many times in the past. And no matter how altruistic your ideas may be when you develop this new thing, if they come along and wave enough money in your face, you're going to cave. And they've done it on many, many occasions in the past. So that's not necessarily a good enough argument to KC2FYJ.
Hey, KC2FYJ, you know that the Justice Department had to stop some of that and make it a little teeny bit smaller, but they did lose a few cases. Like, no longer can Microsoft provide a Java-like interpreter for their browsers. There's a whole big lawsuit thing about their browsers. Microsoft is arrogant, and they will continue to be that way for a long time. You know, Apple sells the product. All their computers will run Windows if you want. It'll run it perfectly, too. You know, unless you've got something that's hardware-based. But, you know, there's been a lot of competition out there. There's other manufacturers like Sun and Silicon Graphics. They're really fabulous machines. They're way beyond what the average user needs. And, you know, Microsoft has their market share. They're not going anywhere.
Help them in order to break them up, N2EO.
Well, you got to be careful. When you broke up Marbell, you made some gains and you made some losses. And so go easy on that breakup, is my opinion. But maybe I'm naive as all hell. That's what you guys are slowly convincing me, that I'm a little bit too, what's the word for it now? You know what I mean. Naive is the best way I can put it. Oh, well. Harry, are we heading in the direction of a disaster, or is it not quite that bad? Is the sky falling, Harry? I'm going to ask Harry first and then Eric in that order. Harry, is the sky falling computing-wise?
No, I don't think it is. I think that it's just got some storm clouds in it and that they will be there for the long term. But I don't think the sky is falling. There's enough alternatives out there that we don't have to worry about Microsoft becoming the sole provider of software. But they are an awfully large provider, and they have an overpowering presence in the office. And I don't think that's going to change in even the moderate term. Personally, if I didn't have to use Microsoft products, I wouldn't. But I have to, because that's what they use at my office. And so I'm stuck with it. I much prefer Unix and Linux, and I feel they're much better, more intelligently designed, and more powerful. But, you know, you got to go with the flow, unfortunately. My opinion, anyhow. Back to you, Dick. This is KC2FYJ.
Glad to hear it, Harry. I mean, glad to hear your opinion. There are people who are in the graphics field who just love Apple machines. Eric, what do you think? Is the sky falling? Where's the state of the art of computing going to be for the next couple of years? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. No, he's right. You know, the sky's not falling. Don't forget, Microsoft is not a national company. It's an international company. Ever since the PC clone came out, the rules of the game changed, and that's the hardware platform. And pretty much everything that runs on that hardware platform is Windows. There's different flavors of Linux or Unix or and host various other operating systems that fit on a PC. But by and large, for the average user not being a computer person, being an appliance operator, if you go back a few years, you remember people like Smithsonian, they used to make typewriters. Well, they kind of went away of the horse and buggy, you know. The reality is that these appliance operators, and there's not hundreds of thousands, not millions, there's hundreds of millions of those appliances out there. And that's pretty much what everybody knows how to use. And that's pretty much the way it's going to stay, because you don't replace all your computers at one point in time either. You change them slowly. As they get old, you want to go to a new, faster technology. You don't buy it, you know, even if you're a company, you don't buy 1,000 computers at once. You may buy 50 or 100 and replace those. And span that over a period of time, you get to be years. You're not all of a sudden going to change your platform. But you will find in other places, specifically other platforms used, as you mentioned, graphics. They like Apple, by the way. When you think of running OS X, you're really running Unix. You don't realize it. It just has a GUI in front of it. There are other places like the servers that provide all these websites, these various different ISPs. Most of them don't run Windows. They run Unix or Linux as their web servers. And you'll find a greater number of those because they're more efficient. They run faster. They're better. They don't crash. There's a lot of good reasons for doing things there. There's also, you're not bogged down with all these crazy APIs. Just do something simple. So that part of the world's not going to change. And if you look at it as a continuous flow from the first PC Junior to the first clones to the stuff that we have today.
Repeater, time out.
Okay, it's a continuation of what exists, are the words that got chopped out. Eric and Harry, Eric in particular, I think you should have added one more sentence. That's the way it is. Do you feel you should have said that to Eric?
It's a while.
Right. Yeah, it is the way it is. There's room for change. There's other devices out there. I mean, I happen to do a lot of what we today call firmware programming because, as I was saying before, like in VTRs, my typical broadcast VTR may have 14 or 18 microprocessors, you know, two just to run a Captain motor. You know, they're dedicated devices to performing what used to be two circuit boards worth of stuff that you can simply write in software. And today it's gotten to the point where you don't even need to use a microprocessor. You just use an FPGA, which has got, you know, a billion gates in it. So, you know, that's the way it is. And it's the way it continues to be. And as the improvement comes, the dies get smaller, you put more transistors on the slab, you get a little more power. You just don't necessarily change the basics. From the very first 186, and then came the 286 and the 386 and the 486, and believe it or not, those microprocessors will run MS-DOS all the way up to the super whoopie-doo Pentium, you know, quad computers. The basic instruction set has not changed. They just add new stuff to it. Back to you, Dick, and then over to Bernie.
Comment?
Bernie first and then comment. Go ahead, Bernie.
Two comments. First off, the comment about break it up like the AT&T system. Keep in mind that, and I grew up in my career through this, the average consumer today pays significantly more for their telephone service than they would have under Ma Bell, bringing it forward with the increased salaries but also adjusting for inflation. So breaking up the telephone system only helped big businesses. It actually penalized the home user who was supposed to help. Second thought is the reason that Microsoft owns the business world is that where else can I send $500 and put a complete PC with a keyboard, with a monitor, with a mouse on my desktop with an operating system in it? I can't go to Dell and order Linux because there's 18 different kinds of Linux to put on it. So the reason we all standardize on Microsoft, unfortunately, is because it's easy, and number two, because it's cheap. Neither one of which are good technical decisions, but both are wonderful business decisions. Just my thoughts, KQ Wild.
Thank you, Bernie. We got approximately 1 minute left. Go ahead, comment.
I wanted to say that it depends on what field you're in. For artists, Apples are much more popular than PCs. They tend to have standardized. Series artists using the paint shop, they're using it on an Apple. And also, they probably don't want Java. A lot of businesses don't want Java running on their systems, especially if they're connected to the Internet. It could always quietly send that information. Back to Net, WWF.
Okay. We're all going to pick this up next week because we haven't settled it, obviously. TechNet number 1,254 is what you heard tonight. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, give us some closing words. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Just some closing words. Got a little bit away from ham radio, but I'll just say a number of things. Ham radio, I know, has gone through its transition also. And in my day, I also work with a calculator and all, and I... If I asked them, what are you doing at all, because they didn't find the program on the computer, didn't know what to do. So I said, well, got to do it with my head sick. That's the way I work. Like you, not a...
For those people who switched over to the 147.375, you can hear the continuing conversation of what Mel had to say. And that's what I'm doing now. It went over to 375, and I'm listening to myself with a 2-second delay. Double again. Eric, first, go ahead. Not required. I've got to go do something else. I've got to go away. 4 hours is enough. Come on, Eric. I gave a couple of delays looking for him, and nobody picked up. So... I admit it, we only did it twice, but twice we did let the machine drop for about 30 seconds.
KQRIW, WA5BJB, with some questions about antennas at home.
Okay, go ahead with your questions about antennas with holes. It's about shy time, Dallas, show up. Boy, you guys are late and slow and wow. What are you, Ken?
Would this be a lot faster on the telephone?
Yes, it would.
Does that create any issues?
I don't think so. Fire away.
WA5BJB, clear.
Reflector, 9126, link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
Disconnected. A2AJ, W2RY, you still listening over here?